You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, sassy school of scone scoffing scallywag scholars. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 182. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your wise and wily wisecrackers wailing about will-o'-wisps and the Nintendo Wii.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. So I'm back.
Yay!
Hello. I was absent for the previous episode, but I was here in spirit because, of course, I recorded a trivia question for you guys.
Yeah.
Which you were able to answer. I was very excited. Hilariously, just in case you recorded another episode while I was gone, I actually recorded a second trivia question that you guys haven't heard.
Oh.
So even though I'm here, we'll just play it. And we'll just pretend for a second
that
I'm not here.
All right. We won't look at you while it plays.
From the Chris Kohler vaults here.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Hello, Good Job Brain co-hosts, and hello to you out there at home. I am still on the east coast of the USA for today's show, and I am thus delivering to you this remote trivia experience. This week, I am in my home state of Connecticut, which boasts various firsts. It's the birthplace of the Frisbee, the Colt 45 handgun, and dental anesthesia. So here is your trivia question. Louis Lunch, established in 1895 in New Haven, Connecticut, is the birthplace of what?
We talked about this, I feel like. Go ahead.
It is the original hamburger.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'd have to listen to the answer to find out.
I believe that's
from
right.
Past Chris.
From what I remember, it's like, it's a different version of a hamburger because you use like sliced white bread instead of buns. Mm-hmm. And then you put it in a weird little, it looks like a little burger torture device. You sandwich it in like a cage and then you put it in a fire.
Well,
that's what I think.
Let's find out.
Hi again. I hope that wasn't too easy for you. Now, to recap, I asked Louis Lunch, a restaurant established in 1895 in New Haven, Connecticut, is the birthplace of what? The answer is the hamburger,
yay!
Which it says it invented in 1900 for a customer who wanted a meal he could take on the go. Louis Lunch grinds the meat fresh in their basement every day and cooks the burger patties in a vertical cast iron flame broiler. Like, imagine a sideways toaster with fire. The burgers are served on toasted white bread with onion and cheese, but no ketchup. There is no ketchup anywhere in Louis Lunch. Thanks for playing, and I will see you guys soon when I get back.
They don't serve fries there?
They don't serve fries there.
No.
No, so
you're back!
I am back. Sooner rather than later, yeah, here I am.
The magic of radio.
No, it is. You can find video of this, but it's a patented design, actually, so nobody else can do it because they built these old cast iron broilers. Or they were new, you know, in the 1800s, but they're old now. They use like a cheddar cheese, like a sharp cheese spread and onions and white bread, but big signs everywhere saying no ketchup.
Whoa.
They don't have ketchup.
I'll kick you out and bring ketchup. Packets in.
Yeah, very different experience to be sure, but it is the hamburger sandwich.
There are a lot of some customer needed something on the go, so
right, the ice cream cone,
the sandwich.
Yeah. A lot of lazy people around.
So I have a cool tidbit from the Twitterverse, from our Good Job Brain Twitter. Benjamin Driggs, hopefully that's his real name, Benjamin Driggs, he sent a video of this thing, but I want to ask you guys first.
Mm. Okay.
What kind of animal is the Portuguese man o' war?
I know.
It's
jellyfish.
Jellyfish?
It looks like a jellyfish.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Technically,
it's a dog.
They also call it a Portuguese water dog. It's the same.
Right.
The Obamas
have one.
Obama
and Sunny.
Yes.
They're siphon. siphonophores or siphonophores. Mm-hmm. Siphonophores? Siphonophores.
Sure.
It is not one animal. When you see a Portuguese man of war, it's not one jellyfish.
It's like a colony?
It is a colony of many organisms built together to look like a jellyfish. Isn't that crazy?
Mecha jellyfish.
Yeah, it's like a Voltron of these a colony of zooids.
So they're not related to jellyfish.
They resemble a jellyfish.
Yeah.
When you go up the genus species, the class, like they kind of all belong the same.
Okay.
Animal,
okay.
Like the Hydra. But this is a collection of different animals. Which is weird because it looks like one clear dumpling and some tendrils.
It's a good survival strategy.
Yeah.
It's like a jigsaw puzzle of a jellyfish.
Like so like some of the zooids in one part of the Portuguese man war is like in charge of this function of the whole colony, and then this one is in charge of another.
I look like an eyeball. Yeah. I look like a tendril.
Thank you, Benjamin, for sending that in. All right. Well, we had a couple of trivia tidbits, but let's jump into our official first general trivia segment, pop quiz, hot shot. And you guys have your barnyard buzzers ready. I have two random Trivial Pursuit cards here. I got Silver Screen and Trivial Pursuit Genus 4.
Okay.
Let's do Silver Screen. Okay. I don't think we've ever done a...
So are these the old movies?
These are old Silver Screen.
Obscure.
Oh, okay.
But I think you can get some.
Let's do it.
No, they're not the old.
Let's do it.
All right.
Blue Edge for setting. What city was the setting for Blade Runner?
Oh.
Colin.
Los Angeles.
Correct. Blade Runner is always
it's a trivia.
Pink Wedge, what did Mrs. Doubtfire win its sole Oscar nomination for? Dana.
Makeup?
Correct. It is makeup.
Seems appropriate.
Oh, dear. Yellow Wedge for OFF. Not sure. Box office? Yeah. Mm. What actor wrote a first novel titled Kid Andrew, Cody, and Julie Sparrow?
Actor wrote a novel.
Hmm.
Kid Andrew, Cody, and Julie Sparrow.
Kid Andrew.
Oh,
I don't know about these actors right now.
This actor we had in trivia last week, and we didn't know.
Huh.
Not that it helps you, listeners.
Oh, wait, who was that?
No, but it would help us.
He was in A Sweet Smell of Success, Colin.
Oh, Tony Curtis?
Yes, okay. It is. Kid Andrew. That's Jamie Lee Curtis's dad, right? They're related?
Yes.
Okay. I guess Silver Wedge, Gray Wedge. Where was the Silver Chalice first used?
What?
So wait, what's that? What's that?
Where was the Silver Chalice first used?
That? Is that in quotes or anything?
Nope.
Or?
What a weird question.
Is it capitalized even? No?
Nope.
Just, where was the Silver Chalice first used?
I don't know.
What's the category?
It says O-N.
Like maybe on location or something?
Yeah. Don't think movies.
Okay.
Just
don't think
where,
movies.
Yeah. Where was...
England.
No.
Egypt.
You're closer. The Last Supper.
Okay. All right.
Huh.
Okay.
Huh.
All right, that makes sense.
All right. That was the first time somebody invented a silver chalice was
first
the last
used.
Supper.
Yeah.
That seems...
It's in the movie, the
Yeah,
last
in
supper.
The movie.
Oh. Right.
Is the answer... Okay.
Yeah.
Is the answer, like, the movie The Last Supper?
Is it italicized?
Nope.
Hmm.
It's not italicized, and the other answers that are...
Okay.
Then I have no idea.
Yeah, weird. Huh. What a weird question. All right. Teal Wedge for pro... production. What Bible epic marked Paul Newman's screen debut?
Bible epic. The Ten Commandments?
No.
Bible.
This is a terrible card.
Yeah, I was going to guess Ten Commandments. I don't know.
The answer is the Silver Chalice.
Come on now. That's just...
Wait, I can't even piece it together. Okay, so Paul Newman.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what?
Now that's
a
movie.
To be fair, you're not supposed to be just reading through the questions on a card.
True, but
okay, but
still,
they're getting a little lazy there.
No idea what the. Yeah, okay.
All right.
That's a movie because that's italicized.
I'm guessing that was a movie about Jesus.
All right, last question. Who did Jose Ferrer portray in The Greatest Story Ever Told?
Chris.
Jesus.
No.
Good guess.
Moses?
No.
And it's Jose Ferrer, I think. Yeah.
Oh.
The silver chalice?
Yeah, nice.
Portray the silver chalice?
It is another biblical...
Judas.
It is Pontius Pilate.
Okay.
Yeah.
You guys want a silver screen. That's what you get.
You know, I mean, now we know why we don't do silver screen.
All right.
Yeesh.
We need to watch our Bible epics.
Yeah, seriously.
I don't even think I've ever learned that reference about the silver chalice. Like,
first appearance of the silver chalice.
Like, I know, I would have guessed Indiana Jones, but I was like, that was a wooden cup.
Right. Well, I mean, they're connected because they're both looking for the Grail. I mean, that's the
Right. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Huh. I know.
What a messed up Trivial Pursuit card.
Oh yeah. Weird. All right. Well, good job, brains.
I bet people who are more familiar with the Bible will be like, what, you guys? We're going to get some actually.
We're old movies.
actually.
Well, we just don't know. We don't know.
Trivia question.
Somebody will explain it. Maybe.
Yeah. Oh,
we'll
see.
Yeah. Yes.
So I suggested our topic for this week, and I want to show you guys what inspired it. So this was just a few days ago. A soccer team in Spain, this is a lower level team, CD Palencia, they rolled out their new uniforms. And I have a photo here for you guys. These are printed uniforms that look like the musculature below your skin, right?
So it's like their skin is transparent.
Exactly. Right. Or removed. Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's really finely detailed. You can see
it's a little creepy.
I have to say it's a little creepy, but I think
science textbook.
It did its purpose, which is it got them all over the internet, all over the news. We are now talking about CD Palencia, a club I did not even know existed, you know. Just a few days ago. So they're pretty cool. And, you know, kind of shows like what you can do now with like screen printing and fabric technology.
Yeah.
But that got me to thinking about, we had never really done a great deep dive on uniforms and, you know, more broadly speaking, like costumes and clothing with a purpose. So I thought that would be a good topic for us to dive into this week.
All right. This week, let's play dress up.
I always enjoy being able to do video game stuff on Good Job Brain. We don't do too much of it. It kind of came up like, oh, what if we talked about what video game characters wear and why they wear those things? And I was like, oh, right. Did we ever do the story of why does Mario look like Mario? Because
it's not because he's a plumber.
It's a really interesting story. No, that was determined afterwards. Mario is a plumber because he looks like a plumber, but why does he look like a plumber?
Okay.
That is the question. So some quick backstory. We are, of course, talking about the Mario of the Super Mario Brothers games. He was created for the 1981 game Donkey Kong. That was his first appearance. The quick backstory on this is that there was a game, an arcade game by Nintendo called Radar Scope. It was like a Space Invaders type game. And Nintendo of America bet very big on this game. So they made a whole lot of them for Nintendo of America, and they put them on a boat, and then the boat took, 3 months to get to America. By the time the boat arrived, Radar Scope was not so hot anymore, and they had a whole lot of arcade games that they could not sell. They were not going to make a lot of money.
I thought you were going to say the boat capsized.
They just had lots and lots of Radar Scopes, and they couldn't do anything with them. And so they call back to Japan kind of in a, you know, very bad way. Like, can you make us a game? You can send us the game and we can print it on. Because basically you had the arcade game. You could take out the ROM chips and the board and put a new game in it. And you could replace, you could slap a new sticker on the side and everything would be okay. If somebody could create a game using that same hardware, that would be better. And Nintendo was like, well, everybody's busy right now, but this guy, Shigeru Miyamoto, he's the only game designer who's free right now to like make you a brand new game from scratch because you messed up. Also, he's never made a game before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's how high priority it was.
Yeah, basically.
Right.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, let me dig you out of your hole. Miyamoto initially started working on a Popeye game because it looked like Nintendo was going to get the rights from Universal, or King Features Syndicate, I believe, is the company to get Popeye. But then that fell through. And so Miyamoto was like, okay, well, I can't do Popeye, but what if I take that same love triangle grouping of characters?
Oh my God.
Yep. Yep. We've blown Karen's mind, everybody.
Donkey Kong is Brutus.
Donkey Kong is Pluto. Exactly.
And then the lady is Olive Oil.
Yep. And then Mario is Popeye. And instead of spinach, he grabs the hammer and becomes, you know, super powered. Initially, he wanted to call Mario Mr. Video, thinking that he would be like the star of all Nintendo's games. But later, he called him Jumpman. Because that was, it was after Pac-Man, basically, because Pac, as in Paku Paku Paku, is the Japanese sound of eating. And of course, this followed Walkman, which was very popular in Japan at this point. It had come out in the late 70s. But the idea was verb man.
Yeah.
Walkman, jump man. And then Nintendo of America was the one who named him Mario. It was after the landlord of their business park. But we're here to talk about costumes. Mario is a weird character. Right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any, it's like, he's not like an adventurer, he's a dude, he has like overalls and a weird floppy hat, and like, where did this come from?
Yeah, like, it doesn't seem like this is part of his job description.
Right. This story really gets to like the genius of Shigeru Miyamoto as an early designer of video games, because he had this innate understanding very early on of like the limitations of game design. Where do I put my priorities? And he designed Mario as the perfect character for a low resolution video game screen of the time. So Mario has a hat. Why? Well, he reasoned, if Mario were to jump off a platform, his hair would have to fly upward. Because that's realistic, right?
Yeah.
Now, most video games just wouldn't deal with this at all. I mean, they would go one of two ways. One, waste precious pixels and animation and code designing it so the guy's hair flies up when he falls. You could do that. Number two, helmet of hair. You know, you could, you could do it that way. Miyamoto figures out the third way, which doesn't waste resources and looks better, which is just give him a hat.
Right.
Mario has a giant nose. Mario has a big bushy mustache. Why? There's not that many pixels to play with. And it's really difficult at this time to give a character a mouth. Because you can go one of two ways. You can give him a, you can draw a mouth, but every character is going to look like the Joker. I mean, there, were, there are, if you see like old Atari games and stuff like that, if the character has a mouth, it, they look like a horror doll.
It's just like a single pixel row.
Or you don't give him a mouth at all and everybody looks like Hello Kitty.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Neither of these are good. Miyamoto gives him a mustache because I'll just give him a big bushy mustache that covers up where the mouth would be.
And it also showcases the nose.
It gives him a nice big nose because, exactly. So you can see he has a face. He has an expressive face. Mm-hmm. Other video game characters at the time, to the extent that there really even were humanoid characters in video games, there really weren't a whole lot at that point. Their face was like a couple of pixels. There was just, it was nondescript. And then finally, Mario wears overalls. Now, the game takes place in a construction site, in an unfinished building that Mario has to climb. He was originally a carpenter before he was a plumber. Mm-hmm. So the overalls kind of make sense, but again, the costume is picked for gameplay reasons. So if you give him overalls, then his torso is red and his arms are blue.
Makes sense.
And he doesn't have to be dressed in like a 1970s rainbow shirt to get that, right?
Or a baseball jersey.
Overalls, which would change the coloration. Now you can see his arms. So that's it. I mean, Mario is designed as a character purely, all of the design elements are there, so that he would stand out well on a low resolution video game screen. The hat, the mustache, the nose, the overalls.
But it translates so well to, not real life, but like it translates so well through the iterations of Mario. Just like that overall look and the hat and the, mm-hmm. And they put the little M on it now.
Right. And they've added a few details here and there.
But yeah. It's almost the same.
Right.
It's funny. I think when I saw his overalls, I was like, he looks like a carpenter more than a painter or a plumber. That's what I thought.
Initially, he was a carpenter.
They usually have the sleeves on their overalls.
Yep.
The plumber,
well, he became a plumber because with the game Mario Brothers, that's where they added in the pipes and the turtles.
The sewer.
Underground. Yeah.
So I ran the iconic Beta Breakers race today in San Francisco. It's like a race, but it's really a big party.
There are people who run it. They run it, you know, like not in costume.
Yeah.
To win a prize.
But I saw so many Marios today.
Really?
So many Marios. Because it's so iconic. And then sometimes it's with Luigi. Sometimes it's a group of people. Mm-hmm. There's Mario.
Sometimes Mario is naked.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. Yeah. So, nice naked Mario costume. Nope. This is just what I look like.
Yeah. That's one of the things at the Beta Breakers is there are a lot of naked people.
Yeah.
I saw this Mario and it was all black leather. And yeah, you know, I'm like, hey, way to go, Mario. That's how I knew it was Mario.
I personally dressed up as Sonic for this race. I usually dress up for all of the Beta Breakers. And I also dress up for basically all the races I run. I'm in an elaborate costume because most of the races I do is in Disney World and Disneyland. And I want to talk about something I'm super excited about. That I learned about Disney and costumes. Okay. So throughout Disneyland, Disney World, and also on the Disney cruises and all the other parks around the world, there's probably $100 million worth of costume that Disney has.
Oh,
okay. And altogether, there's probably 3 million garments and accessories in use.
Yeah.
And when I say costume, you're thinking about like the big Pluto, but I'm also talking about like the cast members there, the people who work there,
sure.
You know, because a lot of their uniforms are themed to, you know, your Fantasyland is like a whimsical thing and your Star Tours outfit is more like futuristic.
Like the Main Street 20s, like one.
Yeah. And so those are also costumes too. That's a lot of inventory that Disney has to deal with
on
a daily basis, hourly basis.
Make sure somebody doesn't drive home in the Pluto suit.
And they actually, nowadays, they're really elaborate. Like some of those costumes, if you look at the costume evolution of some of those big costumes from like the early days, they're kind of nightmare fuel. You know, it's like a guy's face is painted white with big ears and it's just kind of creepy. But now they're to a point where like it doesn't have to be necessarily a human size. Like your head isn't necessarily the character's head. You could be in a giant costume and the person in it has screens. And they have like remote control that they can move eyes, move hands.
Amazing.
Even like there's the more advanced versions of Mickey Mouse. They can listen to what you say and they can talk because there's someone who's in a controlling room. They can control the hands. They can control blinking.
Does it modify the voice?
It does.
To sound like Mickey Mouse?
It does.
That's amazing.
It's pretty high tech. Like I said, $100 million worth of costumes. And what is so genius about the Disney company is that in 2011, they implemented a system. Every single costume has an RFID tag in it. An RFID, just quick recap, is a radio frequency identification. So it uses electromagnetic fields to track and identify things in kind of like a smallish space. It's not GPS where you're beaming a satellite and you're like, oh, this person is in England. You know what? This is like within the parks, within locally, you can track things. And
they're all around us.
All around us. Your employee key card that you go into doors is RFID. Your toll pass on your car is RFID. Oh. And this is a very, very big deal. Because when we're dealing with 3 million different pieces
in
different cities or on a cruise ship, and you need to know, oh, no, I need Pluto's head.
Yeah.
Or if there's going to be some kids having nightmares.
They can identify and track exactly where that Pluto head is.
Man, it's just like on like Star Trek. It's like, you know, locate for me Pluto's head.
So can you imagine before, say in the 80s, 70s, with all of these costumes, all of these, all the people who work at the parks, all of their uniforms, it's manual. tracking by hand where the shirt is, right. Where is the, you know, the pair of shoes you have, you know, the pair of pants that you have to wear for Fantasyland, all manual. In the 1990s, they implemented, which is a better step, with barcode. But then you still have to have a bunch of people scanning stuff every day. In Disney World, back in the barcode era, 25 workers scan the label of every garment that's checked in or out. And it took about 9 to 12 hours to complete. Now it only takes one or two people and it takes an hour with RFID. So with RFID, you have readers and it just automatically reads it and it sends that information to a database. So RFID was implemented in 2011. Within a year, they helped reduce inventory counting time, just keeping inventory, from 180 hours to 2 hours.
Whoa.
Because you just have a reader, you set up a tunnel and things pass through and just reads it. Just like,
exactly. So you can just look at a list and be like, okay, what's in here? Okay, great. Yeah.
And so this is kind of the process. So if you work at Disney, you go to wherever you store all the costumes and the stuff. You pick out your outfit for that day that you need. And you just hang it on a kiosk on a rod and then automatically bleep, 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 knows exactly what you're checking out.
Wow,
it's almost like a library book.
Yeah.
You put on your costume, you do your shift, you come back. All you have to do is throw your uniforms in the laundry chutes. There's readers in the chutes.
Yep.
Goes to the laundry service automatically.
And hopefully yells at you if you're missing something.
Exactly. Well, they actually, I think they take it out of your paycheck if you're missing something automatically too, because it's all done automatically.
Of course.
And then so, you know, the RFIDs have to also withstand laundering of the clothes too, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It eliminates so much error too. Because before, when people are like, you got one shirt and two shirt and whatever, someone's going to make a mistake. Yeah, so that's the tech world of managing Disney costumes. So next time you go to a park and you see Pluto, there's an RFID tag somewhere hidden on his head, probably on his shoes and on his bodysuit. Like,
everything is tracked. Makes so much sense, yeah.
Another place that they do use RFID, they use RFID a lot in theme parks, but in Disney in particular, if you're in Disney World, those soda machines, you know, like in those restaurants, you go to soda machines and you're like, oh, I'm going to have Diet Coke or I'm going to have whatever.
Like the self-service?
Yeah, the self-service one. They're technically not really self-service. So to prevent people from using the same cup and refilling their sodas, like, you know, save money, all of the soda machines are RFID controlled. So you can buy a cup that only allows 6 refills. There is an RFID tag at the bottom of the cup.
Oh, maybe I don't know. I've never seen one of these.
It will not. Oh, it's not in Disneyland. It's only in Disney World.
Oh.
So, so it will not dispense soda unless you have a cup with the tag.
Wow.
And it counts exactly how many refills you get.
Right, right.
So, you know, my mom
That part's easy. I just can't believe they put an RFID tag in every cup.
What if you're mixing soda? Is that like one refill, two refills?
Oh, that's true. I don't think you can mix your Franken-soda.
I don't like the way you think, Dana.
I like Franken-soda. Yeah.
Is that cool?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
All right, well, we've already touched a little bit on video games and sports and costumes for Disney. I will cover maybe the last base here, which is military uniforms. Yeah, so just such a rich area of trivia study. I've put a quiz together for you guys about kind of a grab bag quiz about military uniform trivia.
Current or in the history?
It'll be Amazing. The entire history, let's say, although it's really concentrated in just the last couple hundred years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll start off with a two-part question here. I think the first part of which should be fairly easy. We'll warm you up, guys, with this one here. So get your buzzers ready. Yeah, you can buzz in here. So what do you call the little the fringy, frilly things on the shoulders of old-timey, you know, military regalia uniforms? I think you guys all buzzed in, but I think Karen had it first on the draw there.
Epaulets.
They are epaulets, yeah. You still see them. I mean, there are still, you know, in today's military, there are uniforms that have them. They strike me as old-timey, I think. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. What are they supposed to do?
It is really almost entirely
decorative.
It's just decorative. Yeah. It's like a mark of rank. It's, you know, just to be – they don't really serve a functional purpose, at least not anymore.
Tell people.
Who's the big – you know, who's the head cheese there?
They're like shoulder pads.
They're like shoulder pads.
They make you look bigger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. Draws your eye. So the second part, what does epaulette mean?
Whoa.
What is epaulette? You can probably guess what language it comes from.
Sure.
Karen.
So shoulder armor, I know, is pauldron.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the pauldron.
Oh yeah. So, you're on the right track here.
Like little shoulders?
That's exactly what it means. Karen, pulling it out. Excellent. Yeah, it's French. It means little shoulders. Epaulettes, little shoulders. Well, all right, we've had this question before in Pub Quiz. This one has come up. The Civil War, the American Civil War, you know, sometimes poetically called the Battle of the Blue and Gray.
Yeah.
Which side was which?
Wow.
Which side was which? Which side was blue? Which side was gray?
Easy.
Dana.
Yeah. North is blue.
Yeah.
South is gray.
Yes, that is correct. The Union, the North, was blue, and the Confederacy was gray. The standing army had already been using kind of blue uniforms before the Civil War. So, you know, they sort of carried that through. The Confederacy was there were a number of reasons, but they were a little more homegrown. They kind of had to make do with what they had. In the real early days of the Civil War, it was kind of haphazard. Like, you know, it was not necessarily as standardized as either side would have thought. I mean, there was like friendly fire. Sometimes you're shooting at the wrong guy because serious. I did read at least one source says that sometimes the Confederate troops, if they had, from slain Union soldiers, they would take the uniforms and then like boil and bleach them basically to leach the color out and then use it as like a lighter color uniform.
Yeah.
What is the most notable feature of a Pikohaube? This is a German word, a Pikohaube.
Can you spell it?
Chris has a guess.
It's the big old spike on the top of the German helmet.
Chris has it. Yes, it is what is popularly or sometimes commonly called a Kaiser helmet.
Yeah.
Yes. The German style, originally Prussian helmet with the big old spike on the top. Does not seem very practical. As a kid, I always imagined like, oh, that's like that's your weapon of last resort. Yeah.
Headbutt a dude.
You know,
that's
what I always thought. No, it wasn't really meant
for it. Looks badass.
Yeah.
It was called the Kaiser helmet because it was really popularized by Kaiser Wilhelm II, who wore it, you know, famously and gave his name to it. It was not very functional.
I thought it was for like easy storage of your sandwich rolls.
You just stick it right on top.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, like a kebab.
The Kaiser helmet.
The Pika helmet.
Related to rhinoceros. Or rhinoceros.
Like unicorn. Yeah.
I found out rhinestones really are related to the Rhine River. I wonder if...
Who can say?
Who can say? The closest... it did actually have a functional purpose. It wasn't really inspired by an animal necessarily.
Ring
like,
toss?
It would have a... sometimes if you would see the really fancy...
World War I was long.
Sometimes you'll see, old, you know, paintings or whatever, you'll see in, like, the full parade version, they'll have, like, a horsehair plume coming out the top of the spike.
Yeah,
so that would be the closest thing to a functional purpose that the spike would have.
To make it look pretty.
Yes, to hold the horsehair.
Yeah.
Oh man. So in the course,
to hold my
not to go too deep here on the Pikohaube, but I read that here's how silly it was. So they come up with this like you know metal spike, you know, to be intimidating and kind of just. And then they realize like, oh, you know, sometimes when you're out in battle, maybe it's not so good to have this big flashy thing on the top of your head.
Yeah.
So they came up with a cloth cover to go over the spike,
not to remove it.
No. Right.
No.
During World War II, what specific item of clothing was popularized by the British commandos? Chris.
Daisy Dukes.
That would be something.
British commandos.
Something. Karen?
Oh, World War II.
What were you going to say?
I was going to get gas mask.
Oh, no, no, no. This is a fashionable item, let's say.
Is it the Green Beret?
It is the Green Beret. Yes, Chris has it. That's right. Yeah, which is associated, you know, in America, we associate it with the Army Special Forces. And it is a Special Forces headgear. But the British actually had it first, the British Commandos.
Do they still use it?
The British Special Forces do still use, the beret. And around the world, there are a lot of sort of...
There's the beret.
Yeah. And Special Forces have kind of taken it on. Yeah, but the British, we owe them a debt for that inspiration.
How are they functional?
They're functional in a warfare sense, in that if you're out in the field, they're not going to get in the way. You know, for instance, like having a giant spike on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're climbing in and out of a tank or a helicopter or whatever, it's just, and it's also a way of unifying your squad. It does have a designation purpose, right? Yeah, it is to sort of say like, hey, we're all in the same squad. We're all the Special Forces. But yeah, it's not over fancy. It's just very simple. All right. This one, unless you guys have done a real deep dive on military uniform history, I'm not expecting you guys to know the answer to this, but maybe you will, so I'll give you a bite at it. I'm going to show you a picture here. So listeners, I am showing the crew here a photo of a military gentleman wearing what is called a Sam Brown belt. And this is the wide leather belt across the waist with the diagonal leather strap that runs over the shoulder.
Oh, okay.
All right. Now it's a very common visual symbol of a lot of just kind of military men. It also made its way into like sort of, you see a lot of like dictators. You'll even see like sheriffs. For you wrestling fans, you may remember the Big Boss Man would wear a Sam Brown belt as part of his costume.
Is that Sam Brown?
That is not Sam Brown. Okay. I will show you a photo of Sam Brown in a moment. but I want to ask you guys, do you know at all the story behind the Sam Brown belt? Do you know? This is great. All right. Now let me show you a photo of Sam Brown and see if you can guess maybe the origin.
Okay.
Here's a photo of Sam Brown. He's a British officer.
He has a lot of medals on.
This is a photo of him in his later days. You may also notice he is missing his left arm.
Ah.
Oh.
He has one arm.
It looks like he tucked it in his shirt.
Yes. Yes. During the heat of battle, Sam Brown was leading his men. He was charging a crew reloading a cannon. And today, even though military officers will still sometimes carry a sword, you know, for decorative purposes, back in Sam Brown's day, you would actually use that sword out on the field. You know, it was not uncommon. You're out of guns, you're hand to hand. And he faced a opponent with a sword, hacked off his arm.
Oh my God.
Lost his arm.
Okay.
So now in those days, when you had your sword, you would carry it traditionally, you're right handed, you'd carry it on your left hip. And so you'd have a little clip that holds the scabbard and
you can draw it out.
And you could draw it out. But what he discovered is with no left hand, it was really hard to stabilize the scabbard and reach across and pull his sword out. Yeah. So he improvised a solution. He draped another belt across his chest, clipped it on, and so it would hold his sword holder, his scabbard.
It would stabilize everything.
It would stabilize his scabbard and keep it in place. Yeah.
Sword suspender.
Cool. It was a sword suspender, yeah.
And so that's why other people, even without not being caught short-handed.
Exactly. And, you know, pretty soon after,
like, good to stabilize it.
His men started mimicking him, and it really kind of just caught on.
Yeah.
These days, again, it sort of fell out of favor, one, because, you know, in the military, you don't really carry swords much anymore.
Yeah.
And also, too, they realized that it could also be kind of a liability, like out in battle, because like you could get caught around your neck.
Yeah.
Like it gives you something else for somebody to grab onto. Yeah.
Right.
So when you see it these days, it's really just a decorative purpose. But that is the story behind the Sam Brown belt, which I never knew until just recently. And I had to share that with
that
you guys.
That is interesting. I didn't know what that was about.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Just a little bit of military uniform trivia for you guys.
All right. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back.
Hello, it is I, Elvis, the Good Job Brain 80s robot. I am here to announce that the official Good Job Brain book will be available this fall. Segments, quizzes, original illustrations, puzzles, and weird facts to entertain you humans while you humans engage in your bodily waste excavation sessions in the space known as the toilet. The book will be in both paperback and ebook versions. And you can even pre-order the paperback version on Amazon today. See you on the toilet.
And we're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain. And this week we're talking about uniforms and costumes. And I have a quick tidbit I want to ask you guys. I'm going to give you three names and let me know if you know what they have in common. Okay. As I'm reading them out. The third name is the kicker.
Should we wait for all of them or buzz in when we...
Buzz in when you know.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
All right.
Leo Zelensky. Paul Gamby. And the third one, hopefully we'll seal the deal, Edna Mode. Colin.
They are characters from movies who were costume designers.
Specifically, they are superhero tailors. Superhero costume designers. And I tried,
Fictional. Yeah.
Leo Zelensky is from Marvel, and he's kind of, he has a his own tailoring shop in New York City that he helps Spider-Man and even some of the villains.
They appear in the comic books.
They appear in the comic books. Paul Gamby is the DC version, and Edna Mode you might know from Disney Pixar's Incredibles.
Oh, yes, yes.
I tried researching, like, you know, a lot of the origin of the superhero costumes, like, in the story, how did they get their costume?
Right.
Right? Because, you know, I don't know if you guys watched
Deadpool. They don't really spend a lot of time on
story. Like, you know, not everybody is a master sewer. You know what I mean? And also, like, the fabrics they have to use. There's got to be somebody. And turns out, you know, it's kind of postmodern. They do have a couple of superhero tailors that's woven into the story. And
no pun intended.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even, that was not, that was not intended. That just happened naturally. So yeah, Leo Zelensky from Marvel, Paul Gamby from DC, and Edna Mode from Incredibles. They're superhero tailors.
Nice. I like that. I like the characters that live in the margins of comics.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a grab bag quiz for you guys. It's not exclusively about any genre of uniform, though.
Ooh.
They're just uniforms.
A real grab bag.
Yeah.
So it's not a very uniform quiz is what
you're saying. Right. It's a non-uniform uniform quiz.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know what? I'm going to start with this question because it reminds me of what Colin just talked about. You guys buzz in when I finish reading the question and you have the answer.
All right.
All right. What's the name of the flared hip, tight-legged pants that mounted a motorcycle police wear?
Oh, the flared.
Flared hip.
They're flared hip.
So like inverse
tight
belt buckle.
Yeah, okay. They're not super flattering. Karen?
Jodhpurs?
Jodhpurs.
Yeah.
So in that picture Colin just showed us, like I was like, oh no, because he's wearing jodhpurs in that picture.
That's what he's going to ask.
Yeah. So jodhpurs are... They're Indian pants. They're from in India for hundreds of years. Before the 1800s, in northern India, they got really into polo. There was Asia. Polo is a Middle Eastern, Central Asia sport. India got really into it. And then when the British were stationed there, they got into polo too. In the 1870s, the first modern rules game of polo was played in the UK. And fancy people fell in love with it. Aristocrats, students. Winston Churchill was really into it. They loved it because it trained them for cavalry too. Like you had to ride a horse and do all these fancy tricks. Right. There was a Indian officer, Maharaja, this big guy in India came over. He was really into polo and he brought his team who were like the best people in India and they were from the Jodhpur region. And he was wearing these pants that he had adapted for polo. And everybody was like, those pants are quite fancy. and all of the, everybody started wearing them for all of their sports. Yeah.
And it's named for the region.
It's named for the Jodhpur region. Still today, military and police officers, mounted police, they wear Jodhpurs. They're made of stretchy material and like maybe it's not so much about the give around the butt area, but
it's not as bad, but it's still not the most flattering. U.S. listeners, here's a PSA. On HBO right now, you can watch Troop Beverly Hills if you have HBO.
Oh, hey.
She wears jodhpurs.
She wears jodhpurs.
She does.
You know, one of a Good Job Brain trivia-filled our favorite movie.
They're unisex clothing.
Yeah.
Women in the military, early in the military, would wear them too. Yeah.
You can even turn them around. Doesn't matter which is the front, which is the back. It's convenient.
Would you say hammer pants are jodhpurs in a way?
No, I think they're not tight enough around
the
leg
calves,
part.
Yeah.
It would get caught on the stirrups. Yeah.
They're like maybe if parachute pants and jodhpurs got together and had some offspring.
Hammer pants.
Yeah, maybe it'd be hammer pants.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What's the name of the traditional tall, pleated, poofy hat that chefs wear? Everybody but Colin.
That's a toque.
Toque.
Toque. Yes, that is a toque blanche. It's the white hat.
Yeah.
Did you like my French accent? So there's a legend about the toques, that says that they have 100 pleats because it reminds chefs that there are 100 ways to prepare eggs.
Yeah, bologna.
Really? That's a nice story, though.
It's a nice story. I agree with you. It's a nice story.
Bon Appetit dug around. They were trying to figure out where this came from. They couldn't find any, like, the origin story of this. They interviewed all sorts of experts. They looked through all sorts of old books.
But that's a common saying?
It's a common saying. It comes up a lot.
I've never heard that, really. Yeah. I mean, I don't hang around with a lot of chefs, though.
Every time I look for toque, it was like, the legend goes there are 100, and not every toque has 100 pleats. There are more than 100 ways to prepare an egg.
Yeah. It's a lot more.
But anyway, a toque is a general word for a hat without a brim. And in Canada, it's like a woolen hat.
Oh, that is so confusing. Because they'd be like, oh, it's a toque. I was like, and I'm thinking chef's hat, but they're a beanie.
Yeah.
Like, do you guys wear chef hats going snowboarding? That's weird.
All right. What item of sports clothing was named for a bailiwick in the Channel Islands?
What's bailiwick?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. I'll tell you when you guys get the answer. Colin knows.
That is a jersey.
Jersey, yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, like Jersey and Guernsey.
We talked about New Jersey and original Jersey. Yes.
They're bailiwicks.
Bailiwicks. So it's an area under the jurisdiction of a bailiff. Mm. So Jersey is kind of a weird spot internationally. Like, it's not part of the UK. It's not part of France. There were some treaties that went on with it, with Normandy. They get all of their legal stuff solved by a judge, by a bailiff. It's weird, but I was like, oh, that word comes up, and I had no idea what it was until today.
That's a great,
Is the shirt Jersey named after?
Yes.
And how come?
They were known for making these, like, kind of tight-knit sweaters that are pullover sweaters. They were really good for sport, for fighting, for soldiers. And then it came to the U.S. and the football outfits needed, like, more protection. So they started wearing the sweaters, and they called them jerseys. And then jersey meant any kind of sweater. And then eventually it meant any kind of sport top.
Yeah.
Finally, Cliff Clavin, the mailman from Cheers, often wore his uniform to the bar. And what style of jacket did he wear? And as the hint, it was named for a U.S. president.
Oh. Whoa. Until you give me the hint. It must be an Eisenhower jacket.
It's an Eisenhower jacket or an Ike jacket.
I've never heard of that.
Huh. Yeah, I have an Eisenhower jacket. It's
what does it look like?
It's just like that very classic old style. Like, you would see, like, guys working at, like, a gas station, you know, would wear it.
Okay. It's waist height. Yeah, tailored. It's roomy, but also sharp. Developed near the end of World War II, President Eisenhower was like, these jackets aren't very practical or neat. The jackets that people were wearing were, like, kind of restrictive. They were too long. They also looked, like, a little bit sloppy. So he got his tailor to snazz up his jacket and, like, to make
He was responsible for it.
They named it for him because he was the one who was like, oh, look at me and my sharp new jacket. Yeah. Everybody was
look at me. I'm a fashion designer / president.
I thought it was just that, like, because he wore it, like, he popularized it. That's even better. Yeah. And a bit of a micromanager, it sounds like.
Everybody liked it. It was more comfortable, and it did look better.
I like it. I like the look.
You wear these all the time.
I do.
Colin,
it fits my. It's my aesthetic. Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't know.
Cool.
That's cool. All right, go Ike.
Hey Matt, did you know that wombats poop cubes?
Nope, never heard that before.
Did you know the unicorn is the national animal of Scotland, Ken?
I didn't know, nor do I care.
Neil, did you know that Liechtenstein is the only doubly landlocked country in Europe?
Jeff, isn't that an American pop artist?
Well, actually, it's both. If you want to learn things like that and more, join us each week on Triviality, a pub trivia-style game show podcast where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Listen in each week to answer general knowledge trivia alongside exciting guests from around the world.
And we're here too.
Join us every Tuesday for new hour-long episodes of Triviality, plus tons of extra theme content on everything from The Office and Lord of the Rings to science and geography.
And sometimes we even do sports.
Find us on all your preferred podcast apps and take part in the fun of playing bar trivia without the need to wear pants.
Real mature, Jeff.
Forget it, Neil. It's Triviality.
So, Colin, you talked about military uniforms. Thankfully for me, because I have prepared this entire thing, assiduously avoided the subject of camouflage.
Yes.
Which is what I want to talk about. When you hear the word camouflage, your mind probably goes to the same thing, that particular style of sort of pattern of blobs of green and brown and beige on a and somebody hiding in the woods, basically. In the general sense, camouflage has been around for a very long time. Like, you don't need to be a technological super genius to figure out, like, oh, if I paint my boat blue, then it will be slightly harder to see against the blue ocean. And in fact, in the 4th century, there are stories of people doing this, of militaries, you know, with blue painted boats. Everybody's wearing blue, so that, you know, it's just
any little advantage you can get.
A little bit harder to see them, right? Exactly. Camouflage, importantly, is not just to hide something. It is to disrupt your vision. It is to make you not sure of what exactly it is you're seeing. For a while in World War I, they used what was called dazzle camouflage. After like razzle dazzle. and basically just, to make you not sure of what it is you're seeing. It doesn't, what they would do is they would take the warships and paint like
weird
diagonal lines,
yeah.
Right? All kinds of weird diagonal lines all over the place. This made the ships, if anything, much easier to see. You could see that there was something there, but you didn't know which way the ship was oriented.
Yeah.
You didn't know how many guns were pointed at you. Like, that was the idea behind it. Every now and again, you know, maybe on an airplane, you run into somebody who's in military fatigues. They're in their Army uniform or their Marines uniform. But something that you may have noticed if you've seen people traveling in military uniforms is that instead of wearing they are in camouflage. Like, camouflage is part of their official, you know, uniform.
They're not blobs anymore.
They're not blobs. No. They're
digital.
Pixels.
Digital
they're
camouflage.
Digital. Yeah. They look like old video game characters, basically.
Yeah. You're going to say, oh, if you've seen them traveling, you'll notice their camouflage now matches the plane seat.
Good.
Wouldn't that be great? You know, I mean, that is coming. Yeah. I mean, they are testing a lot of things that use fiber optics that figure out what does it look like behind me, and then project that into fiber optics in the front of me. Yeah, the invisibility cloak.
Bananas.
Yeah. No bananas.
Well, you can stand in front
camouflage
of bananas.
Camouflage. Yeah,
where did the bananas go?
First use of what we would know as pixelated camouflage was in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
Now retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Timothy O'Neill, who is still a consultant and an expert in the field of camouflage. The problem he was trying to solve was, how do you get camouflage to scale?
Yeah.
Because if you paint an intricate pattern on somebody, well, that's great for close up, but then they get far away.
You can't see
a person,
color.
Right? Yeah. Meanwhile, if you take a tank and paint bigger blobs on it, well, that's great for super far away, but it's not good for up close.
It's like, I see it, yeah.
So you can't get the traditional camouflage pattern to actually scale appropriately. The idea was that by doing the mosaics of squares, you could do micro patterns where you get up close and you see a whole bunch of little squares and it meshes well with the background. But then as you get far away, you can also make them into macro patterns.
Right, right.
So it's like a fractal. You know, the pattern sort of repeats itself as you zoom out, right?
Whoa.
So that was the idea behind it. I mean, in the test that they did, it actually worked. It actually did blend in better with the surroundings. And it was effective enough that by the 1980s, Canada was the first country to adopt this digital camouflage, and put it on everybody's uniform.
Canada.
It was
Yeah,
and it was called. It was a patented, I believe, process because it's actually illegal in Canada to use what is known as CADPAT, which is short for the classic military acronym, which isn't really an acronym; it's more like an abbreviation.
Yeah,
Canadian Disruptive Pattern.
Okay.
CADPAT.
Private citizens cannot use it.
Interesting.
It is like impersonating a military officer.
Okay.
Use that particular pattern.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
The U.S. Marines followed very shortly after with MARPAT, Marine Pattern.
Sure.
They switched over fully in 2004, and the Army was like, oh, we want to adopt a similar, we want something that cool, too.
ARMPAT.
ARPAT.
ARPAT.
Yes. I believe that was one of the abbreviations for
That's
one of the things
we did.
That's
not the guy from Twilight.
Yeah. Right. The Army wanted to adopt this pattern, but they made one very bad decision.
What?
for some weird reason, they decided that it would be cool to just have one color scheme called the Universal Camouflage Pattern. Mm. With the idea is like, oh, this color scheme, which was like, it's very light. I mean, if you see somebody in sort of a very light, like dusty gray, gray, light green, beige, it looks a little more dusty, like gravelly. It was supposed to work well in any environment.
And it doesn't?
It doesn't work well in any environment. Basically, they were just like, we stick out like sore thumbs everywhere. In the woods, we look tan.
Right. In the desert,
we look gray.
Yeah.
In the snow, we look gray. The Marines had different color schemes. They had woodland. They had desert. They had snow. But the Army, for some reason, was like, everybody same color. There was a whole lot of blowback. The Army is already well on their way to introducing a pattern to replace the digital camo. The thing is, a lot of the blowback, and I tried to find some sort of definitive source in the internet that would say, like, this camo pattern is better than the blobby camo pattern. But you have people who are saying, yes, it's absolutely better. And you have people saying, no, it's actually not better. But a lot of the blowback, which was really about the color scheme of the digital camo
pattern.
It's being reflected onto the pattern because people are like, well, I knew those stupid pixels wouldn't work. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of like it's confirmation bias of like, oh yeah, well, you know, obviously pixels aren't going to make you blend in the environment. And so that is the problem. Wow. But the people are like, no, 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 no. It's the pixels are not the problem. The color scheme was the problem. But the Army tested a whole bunch of different replacements. They're going back to the blobs.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Really?
So the Army, so the Marines still use Marpat. The Army is going back to the blobs.
I didn't know. Ah, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Still highly debated on the effectiveness of it.
It's got to be so hard to, I mean, like you could do like a lab vision test, but that's not simulating a battlefield condition, you know? I mean, it's got to be really hard.
They show pictures to people and they see how long it takes them to find the anomaly, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we got one last segment. Colin, serve it up.
Well, I started with an allusion to sports uniforms. I will close out with some sports-related uniforming knowledge here for you guys. Two fun sports, sort of like sports uniform goof-related stories here. So the NFL, which is the National Football League for American football, last year they rolled out a program called the Color Rush, okay? And this was in combination with Nike, one of their major marketing partners. And generally, when you're watching sports, one team will have a light-colored jersey or uniform. One team will have a dark-colored jersey or uniform. Very often, almost always, it's white and some other color, or, you know, variation thereon. So the NFL decided, what if we had both teams wearing color? So not white and something else. We'll roll out big, brassy colors. And, you know, this is partly to sell more jerseys. And also because they wanted to just jazz it up a little bit. So they rolled out the program for some games later in the season where the teams would come out. And so there was one game with the Buffalo Bills wearing bright red jerseys and the New York Jets wearing bright green jerseys. Okay. And it, you know, it sounds very Christmas-like, right? And it looked okay, I suppose,
not
if you're a fan of the teams. That's right. Dana has it. It is not friendly to the colorblind. So almost immediately, as the game is going on, colorblind viewers are getting on Twitter, on Facebook online. They're like, hey, NFL, it looks to me like both teams are wearing the same jersey. I cannot tell what is going on here because they're the same level of saturation of the colors.
It's like more common in men. It's a big percentage.
Yeah, because more men are colorblind. Yeah.
Yep, that's
more
right. They say it's about 6%. And that's 6%
that's
of
a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And this is red-green colorblindness, of course, but there are other types of colorblindness, right? So the NFL, I mean, it amazes me for an institution that makes so much money from television that, like, from the concept stage all the way up through execution, nobody at any point raised their hand and said, hey, this is a bad idea because this is a televised sport. And to me, at least, the irony is that part of the reason in football teams had white jersey, colored jersey originally was because when the game was first televised,
black and white.
on black and white TVs, it was the same effect as if you had, you know, no color vision. So this year, for this year's Color Rush games, the NFL has said they're going to make sure.
So it's one game that they can
It's a series of games. Okay, it's a series of games. Yeah, so they'll brand it as tonight's a Color Rush game. They've said this year, we're going to make sure that they're high contrast. So all of our colorblind viewers watching at home can enjoy this game just like everyone else.
Yeah.
All right, and lastly, I will share a little anecdote here. So we have talked before about Michael Jordan and his jersey number. We talked, I think, on a previous episode how he wore number 23, he retired, he came back, he had to wear number 45 for a while. He eventually switched back to number 23, famously. But I want to tell you guys, there was one single game in Michael Jordan's basketball career where he wore neither number 23 nor number 45. This was a game in 1990, the Chicago Bulls, for whom he played. They were playing the Orlando Magic. Someone in the Orlando Arena, prior to game time, made off with Michael Jordan's jersey out of the locker room.
You only had one?
So they were traveling. They were on the road. If they were in Chicago, it would have been a little bit easier to wrangle another Michael Jordan jersey. It just went missing. You know, I mean, it's not like the locker room is just, you know, open to the general public. Mm-hmm. So
inside job.
Well, yeah.
Or inside arena job.
It's right. Definitely. It definitely seems to be that it was an inside job. But whoever took it, it was missing. So they looked around. They interrogated some people. They couldn't find a jersey for him. This is my favorite part of the story. They went out into the crowd, into the stands.
Yeah.
Looking to see, like, hey, maybe somebody here has a jersey that will fit Michael Jordan.
Oh.
And we can buy, not looking for the stolen jersey, looking for a replacement.
Just, like, some kid, like, so excited.
They could not find one that was big enough to actually put on Michael Jordan. So luckily, the equipment manager and the team manager traveled with, for just this circumstance, a blank jersey with a number but no name on it on the back. So it was a generic number 12 Chicago Bulls jersey.
Huh.
And so for that one game, Michael Jordan wore a jersey number 12, no name on the back, and they said he was in a really bad mood after. I think what happened, I mean, it's never been confirmed what happened, but there are rumors that the jersey surfaced later in the in the other locker room, you know. Well, I mean, this is pre-eBay.
It was a prank. Okay.
I imagine, my guess is someone did it either just to kind of stick it to Jordan or maybe to hope and sell it on the black market and then started sweating when they realized, like, oh, I'm not going to make it out of the arena with this jersey.
It's unclear
exactly what happened. Dana, the Bulls lost that game, to answer your question, although Jordan did score 49 points.
Okay. I guess he had pretty good.
So not for nothing.
He didn't sign autographs after the game, which he normally did. He going to just get on the
disrupted
flight back.
Disrupted his mojo.
It disrupted his mojo. So that's a very, to me anyway, as a basketball fan, an interesting little footnote to the what was Michael Jordan's jersey number saga.
Well, let's not feel too bad because I read that Michael Jordan makes $100 million a year. Now he's not even playing anything. From his marketing, from his licensing deals, $100 million.
Those underwear commercials.
Yeah.
Oh, Hanes.
Well, so you know what's interesting? I mean, speaking about marketing and uniforms. So Karen. So he has his own. It's the Jordan, which is a sub brand of Nike, right?
So
Nike does all the manufacturing and everything. But there are Jordan athletes as opposed to Nike athletes, and there are Jordan brand basketball players. And so as you may know, Michael Jordan is now the primary owner of the Charlotte Hornets basketball team. So what the league made him do basically was put up a wall, kind of like when the new president comes into office and they have to put their, stocks into a blind management kind of thing. He is no longer allowed to be involved in choosing what athletes are Jordan athletes, because before that could be a really big deal, right? If Nike's trying to sign an athlete.
Who's currently a Jordan athlete?
I believe like Carmelo
Anthony?
I believe Carmelo Anthony is a Jordan athlete in the league. Yeah. Okay. I believe Derek Jeter, I think, was a Jordan brand athlete outside of basketball.
That's not even the same sport.
Yeah.
He played baseball too.
Yeah.
That's true.
But so these days, like the NBA players who are chosen to be Jordan brand ambassadors, like he's not allowed to choose them. Yeah. Cause it's like collusion basically or interference with league matters. Right. Conflict of interest. Right.
Charlotte Hornets.
Right.
Crazy coincidence.
Yeah.
And that's our episode. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening. I hope you learn a lot of stuff about Armpat. Sam Brown Belt, Disney, and Mario. You can find our show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, on Spotify, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.